Today on Against the Grain, film in the 20th century conjures up the glamour of the big screen as well as the intimacy of family snapshots. According to film historian Alice Lovejoy, celluloid and its successors should also bring to mind war. She reflects on the history of film companies like Kodak in the making of the atom bomb, chemical warfare, and the legacy of radioactive fallout. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The material of film, in the words of Alice Lovejoy, is a cousin to textiles and car tires, yet its exalted use in cinema and photography obscures the key role the film industry played in 20th century production for war. Kodak, the world's largest film manufacturer, and its German competitor Agfa easily morphed into military contractors, the former helping to create the atom bomb dropped by the U.S. on Hiroshima, and the latter using slave labor to assist the Nazi war machine. Lovejoy is professor of film and media studies at the University of Minnesota. In Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War, she delves into film's materials and chemicals and their use in warfare and mass destruction. Alice Lovejoy is a former member of the editorial staff of Film Comment, and her other books include Army Film and the Avant-Garde. Alice, when we think of film, we don't usually think about the materials and the people who manufactured them. How does our picture of the golden age of film change when those materials and those labors are taken into account?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really is at the core of the book. And I think it is about rethinking, or I can't think of a better metaphor for it, reconceiving of the nostalgic lens that we use to think about companies like Kodak, which, invented the snapshot, helped bring home movies into existence. It really is still a household name. But one of the things that the book shows through these materials is just how much companies like Kodak, and especially Kodak, were and are chemical companies, really major chemical companies, and just how much the film that we think of as core to their histories depended on the mass production of other things like plastics, like artificial fibers, like rayon, like pharmaceuticals, and like weapons. It also shows just how deeply companies like this were involved with the military-industrial complex, both in the U.S. and abroad, in the many different forms that this has taken, and how it was caught up with other kinds of violence. So not just military violence, but also colonial violence and environmental violence. And I think to your question, this is really a very ordinary history. It's a history of a commodity that was made in an industrial complex that looked a lot like industrial complexes making other things that we might think of as having less of an aura around them, things that are less tied to culture and maybe family history and memory, more everyday products. But film was one of those. It was extremely everyday in the ways it was made and in the ways the businesses were organized. And tracing it back through materials allows us to see that, right? On the one hand, through diversification. So gelatin, for instance, one of the stories the book tells is about the Eastman Gelatin factory in Peabody, Massachusetts, which is near where I grew up. And gelatin is a product that can be used to make photographic emulsion, which is the kind of gelatinous, because it's made of gelatin, material that sits on top of film and makes it photosensitive. But it can also be used to make glue and food grade gelatin. And so when you start to think of these materials, you open up a whole web of industrial and chemical relations and a whole web of product lines that are central to film's role in our world and really what it is.
And we'll trace as we go the history of company codec, especially in all sorts of crucial moments, actually, in the American century. But I want to ask you about what were Kodak's beginnings and how did it take off?
Yeah, so the company began at the end of the 19th century making materials for still photography. So this began with glass plates, which were plates of glass that were coated again with photosensitive emulsion. And it moved up through the kinds of roll films on celluloid that your listeners who have taken photographs with a still camera might know very well, through motion picture film as well. So this is a story of a photographic company, but the story that I tell is a parallel to this as well, about the company that, you know, Kodak was a company that from the very beginning aimed to be the global leader in film manufacturing. Its founder and its president, George Eastman, was very committed to being the world's best and the world's largest film manufacturer, which brought the company, on the one hand, all around the world with subsidiaries in you know, throughout the world. But also it made it into a company that was very invested in controlling the means of production and controlling the materials that it used. So we're getting back to the first question here too. So this, one of the stories that the book tracks is how in the aftermath of an antitrust case in the early 1920s, after Kodak had been found to be a monopoly in the photographic industry by the Department of Justice in the United States, how the company turned to vertical integration as a way to expand and grow. And by vertical integration, I mean buying not companies that made film or cameras, which is something that it had done before and which had been told not to do anymore, but by buying factories that made the raw materials that went into making film and cameras and the other products that it made. So that is really the core of the story. And the factory that I focus on in Kodak's case is the Tennessee Eastman Corporation, which is now Eastman Chemical. It's still a major player in the U.S. chemical industry, and it's headquartered in Kingsport, Tennessee. And Kodak ended up in Kingsport right around the time that it was dealing with the aftermath of the antitrust case and the consent decree. It came to Kingsport within a New South economy that was trying to lure northern companies to Appalachia and elsewhere in the South to capitalize on what was being marketed as the region's cheap labor and its abundant raw materials. And for Kodak, this was a way to start making one of the chemicals that it really needed to make its film, methanol or wood alcohol, because there was a major lumber industry in this area of Tennessee, and there were factories that had been sort of left abandoned after World War I, after the chemical weapons industry had emerged in the United States during that war.
Well, tell us, and you've already started to do so, about the components. Now, some of this actually changed over time, but at that point, the components that were necessary in terms of materials to make film. You mentioned gelatin, which I believe is made from animals, and also wood. How was film made at that point, and what were the resources that were necessary to make it?
Yeah, so when we think about film, there are two basic layers. One is the base, the celluloid base, which is the strip of film that we would, you know, load into a camera, which is made. Now it is made of a substance called cellulose acetate, sometimes of polyester, an oil-based substance. But initially it was made of cellulose nitrate, which is made of cotton, cotton linters, which are little fibers attached to the cotton seed, of nitric acid, and of other chemicals. And as we know, nitric acid plus cotton linters is nitrocellulose, which is highly explosive. So when we think of film base, we can think of these earlier kinds of cellulose nitrate film base, which is highly flammable, and then later less flammable alternatives like cellulose acetate base, which didn't use nitric acid, and also polyester bases. So we have the cotton linters, and we have nitric acid, we have acetic acid and acetic anhydride. anhydride, other chemicals that go into the base. And then on top of the base, we have the emulsion, which I mentioned has gelatin, but also has silver. Silver is really key to the photosensitivity and to the way film reflects shadows and light. And then other chemicals like dyes, which make film sensitive to colors, right, that it encounters in the world. So these are sensitizing dyes, and they are organic chemicals in many cases, made originally from coal. So those are some of the materials that I look at in the book, and I track some of them through various global, really kind of circuitous paths.
Right. So presumably these materials did not all just come from the areas surrounding the factories that Kodak established. So how far-flung were the sources of the materials?
They were far-flung. In the case of gelatin, we have to think of this as stretching into South Asia and to Southeast Asia. We have good records on that. Because gelatin is made out of animal bones and hides, the bones and the hides were shipped from there, also from Argentina, which has a very large cattle industry, right? So the byproducts of the cattle industry end up being used for the gelatin industry. We can think of silver, which in the case of Kodak was mostly mined in the United States, as far as I understand it. And we can think of cotton, which relied heavily on the cotton economy in the U.S. South, which was really the major supplier of cotton, not just for the U.S. Photographic manufacturing industry, but really for the global photographic manufacturing industry.
So you mentioned that Kodak was sort of allured to Tennessee with the promise of a cheap workforce. Who worked for Kodak? And you're talking, of course, during a time of legal segregation.
Yes. So in the 1920s, one of the reasons that Kodak discussed moving or establishing a factory in Tennessee was not just because the chemical warfare industry had left a factory that was ready to be used. And it wasn't just because there were a lot of trees, but it was also, and this is what executives said at the time, because there was I think they called it an American workforce, which was code for a white workforce. The company was known for having a primarily white workforce in various of its factories. But in the case of the South, this had to do with a context on the one hand of a town, Kingsport, which was a planned community, a planned and segregated community that was really built around as scholars of the town have shown, was built around the availability of labor from people who might have been farmers or mountaineers in other contexts, and in the context of the New South, were being moved into or encouraged to move into industrial positions, especially as members of the Black community moved north, looking for better treatment, for better jobs, etc. So this is part of the history, again, of the New South and of the Great Migration that formed the background to this. So this is also in the context of anti-Bolshevist, as using the terms of the day, sentiment in around 1919, 1920, which kind of layered racial dynamics on top of anti-communist and anti-Soviet dynamics in the United States. And so there was a very strong association between the white workforce in Kingsport and a sense that this was a move away from so-called Bolshevism, right? That was a danger that was inherent with racial integration as well.
Film historian Alice Lovejoy is my guest. We're discussing her book, Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I just want to take a moment to ask you before we get to World War II, thinking about the film industry in the context of World War I, because both of the World Wars obviously played a crucial role in, among other things, industrial research and application And after each war, one could see the sort of use of technologies that were developed during the war then spill over into society following them. So how did World War I shape the fortunes of the film industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is a story, I think, in a large sense of chemical warfare that we can track through two wars and counting. And so for World War I, the dynamics go both ways. On the one hand, the film industry was involved with the organic chemical industry in Germany and in France because of those sensitizing dyes that I've mentioned that help attune film to light. And those organic chemicals, when they stopped circulating during World War I, some of them were made into poison gas. So that is part of a history that goes from the film industry and the dye industry into chemical weapons histories. But on the other side of that, for World War I, we have to remember this is the first air war. It's the first time when airplanes are a major force in fighting. And at the time, airplanes had canvas wings and canvas bodies, which is not very helpful when it's raining or snowing. It's not, you know, very weatherproof. And so early in the war, one of the things that was used to weatherproof airplanes was cellulose nitrate, which isn't a great idea either, because it's extremely flammable and extremely explosive, again, because of its links to nitrocellulose. So a major role that factories like Kodak's and Rochester played in World War I was in using cellulose acetate, which is the slower burning form of celluloid that I've spoken about, as a way to coat airplane wings. So it wasn't just Kodak that was doing this. It was companies like Pathé in France and Agfa in Germany. It was a really important innovation that allowed Kodak, in its case, to build entire new factories at the government's expense for making these airplane coatings. And after the war, those factories and that infrastructure and those materials could be repurposed for film, for the non-flammable film that I've discussed earlier. So there is a very direct connection. And I think this is something that we see, as you've mentioned, we see this in so many cases, right? That there is a certain amount of government initiated research and development that goes on in industry. And in this case, that had to do in large part with this non-flammable plastic. Again, for airplane, what was called airplane dope, as in a kind of viscous substance, but also for things like gas mask components, which you also don't want to be flammable. So all of these plastics became central to World War I.
That shift from flammable cellulose to non-flammable, when non-flammable technology or a non-flammable process of creating film was invented, what kind of implications did it have to the way that the material was then made? Was the process significantly different? Were the materials coming from elsewhere, or was it more of a more subtle sort of shift in how it was produced?
Yeah, it was a subtle shift in general, because the substances themselves are not too chemically different. It's a matter of some different solvents, I believe, used to make the substances, right? So cellulose nitrate and cellulose acetate are relatively similar. It did take a while for cellulose acetate to work well as a kind of film, because it was initially too brittle, it was too hard to splice, it had all sorts of problems that companies like Kodak worked on until you got to about the early 1920s, 1923, when the first 16mm camera was released by Kodak, the Cine Kodak, which was a home movie camera that used non-flammable film. It wasn't going to catch on fire when you were filming your children or showing a film at a kind of business meeting. And it was transformative. Industrial processes themselves were not too different, but the chemical components were different. And then the payoff in terms of how it reframed where cinema could be, where you could watch movies, what kinds of movies you could make as a person who wasn't a professional, those changes were enormous.
And what about workplace safety for those people who were using those materials?
So one of the dangers that Kodak was very aware of, and other film companies were very aware of in the early part of film's history, so in the first 2 decades of the 20th century, was that nitric acid is extremely dangerous. It is a corrosive substance. It's an acid. It is dangerous for workers' lungs. And so these companies, these factories, were equipped with excellent ventilation. They were very well ventilated to try to protect the workers from industrial accidents and industrial health issues that might arise from working with the acid. There were absolutely other industrial issues with cellulose acetate, but those initial ones were kind of mitigated. And one of the ironies that I track in the book, though, is that when we look at companies like Agfa in Germany and Pathé in France, the ventilation that was built into factories as a worker safety measure also made these film factories excellent places to either bottle poison gas during World War I or to manufacture it. Now, I'm not talking about Kodak here, and I'm not talking about the United States, but it is a matter of a kind of international factory design at this time that was, again, thinking about worker safety, but also allowed other kinds of real danger to emerge, the danger of the deadly danger of poison gas, which killed so many during World War I.
Well, let's move to World War II. So you had been talking about this factory in Tennessee that was acquired by Kodak. What were its fortunes and the fortunes of the company more broadly during World War II?
Yeah, so we see after the 1920s, after the mid-1920s, Tennessee Eastman becoming a really major force in the US chemical industry because of its work with cellulose acetate, which was, again, the substance that made non-flammable film for 16 millimeter, but that also went into making rayon. And rayon became the company's biggest and most important product. It was really what got it through the Great Depression. We have to remember this is a moment in history where artificial fibers were taking off. And they were, you could make them domestically, you didn't need to import. Import silk, you didn't need to import wool, etc. So making cellulose acetate was a springboard to much larger things during World War II. And the first of these is an explosive called RDX, or Research Department Explosive, which is an explosive that was used widely during World War II to combat U-boats, German submarines. Because it was at that point really the most powerful explosive available. So during the war, there wasn't a way to mass produce this. It was kind of batch produced, so made batch after batch after batch, but that wasn't enough for the scale of this war. And RDX uses two chemicals that are in cellulose acetate, acetic acid and acetic anhydride. So the government asked Tennessee Eastman to run an RDX factory in Kingston to mass produce RDX, mass produce this explosive, which it did very well. And it became, and this is really, I think, a striking way to put it, and this is from historian Tom Lee's work, that this made the world's largest film manufacturer, Eastman Kodak, the company that was in charge of the world's largest explosives plant, which was this RDX factory in Kingsport, the Holston Ordnance Works. So that was the beginning of it. This was a factory that had continuous production. So RDX kind of rolled off its assembly lines night and day. It got up and running very, very quickly because Kodak's chemical engineers were excellent at building factories that worked quickly and worked well. And because the company was so good at this, about a year later, it was asked by the Manhattan Project to run what became the Y-12 uranium separation plant at Oak Ridge, which was being built at that time, not too far away from Kingsport. And now it wasn't asked to do this because it had any experience in uranium separation. It was asked to do this because it was very good at mass producing chemical products. So whether that product was RDX or cellulose acetate for film or rayon. And this is a skill that the company had become very good at mass production. It had become very good at mass production by making film in its early days, making film at Rochester by trying to become and successfully becoming the world's largest film manufacturer.
Let's turn for a moment to Kodak's rival in Germany, Agfa, which you mentioned earlier. What was its history because your book focuses on Kodak and Agfa. And how does it become, in World War II, part of the Nazi war machine?
Yeah, so Agfa was, it got started making film a bit later than Kodak, but it's an interesting comparison to Kodak because while Kodak got into chemicals like cellulose acetate and rayon, chemical products like rayon, through film, Agfa came to film from being a dye maker. So its work was in dyes and other related chemical products, and then it came to film. So it gets started somewhat later, and it was a company that became Kodak's largest competitor, especially in the 1920s. It was the one that George Eastman was the most worried about. And during the war, you know, we can't directly compare the two companies' work during the war because they were doing very different things, and the relationships between the government, the military, and industry in the United States and Nazi Germany were very different. But Agfa did similar kinds of military research and development to the work that Kodak did. So this would have been research, for instance, into films that could be used for aerial photography, films that could be used for infrared photography, things which are useful to militaries. But to the point of what I discuss in the book at length, it was part of a military industrial system that was inseparable from Nazi Germany's concentration camps because Agfa was part of the IG Farben chemical cartel. So this meant that Agfa's Wolfen factory in the eastern part of the country, which I write, which I focus on in my writing, was, which made film, but also made rayon and other products, that it was using forced laborers and concentration camp prisoners to make its products, both film and rayon and other things that it made. And so there are histories here about Nazi Germany's colonial dimensions, about the ways in which it was working to make an empire throughout Eastern Europe, especially using Ukrainian laborers, forced laborers, Russian forced laborers, Polish forced laborers, and others. And also in thinking about the similarities between between Agfa and other film companies at the time, which were very invested in tracking raw materials and finding raw materials for their products, and how this built other colonial threads in the company's history.
Tell us more who worked there. You mentioned that they were people who were being forced to work. What were their gender primarily? What do we know about who worked in these factories?
A large proportion of the people who worked in film factories in general, but specifically at Agfa Wolfen, were women. And during the war, there were particular relationships between the factory and the Ravensbrück women's concentration camp in Germany, as well as between it and Buchenwald, another camp. And so I track the story in the book of a Ukrainian woman named Oleksandra Lavrik, who was from Dnipro, the city of Dnipro in Ukraine, which is very much in the news today. She was active in the local Communist Party. She was a factory accountant, and she was arrested for her political activities multiple times after the German occupation of Ukraine, the Soviet Union, and of Ukraine. And she was ultimately deported to Germany and chosen through a selection by film factory executives to come work at the factory in Wolfen. So she, like other women working at the factory, worked in the film parts of the factory, but she also worked in the rayon parts of the factory, and this left her with horrible lung injuries that she maintained to the end of her life. And so there are stories here too, again, going back to the colonial dimensions, about who was seen as expendable in terms of labor, who was seen as, moldable through work into sort of ideal colonial subjects. These were things that the factory executives talked about a great deal with their, especially their Ukrainian, Russian, and Polish forced laborers. And these stories are closely caught up with the industrial system that underpinned the concentration camps.
Now, of course, obviously, Germany lost in World War II, the United States did not, Kodak continued. What was the fate of Agfa and its factory that you focus on, Wolfen? at the end of World War II.
Yeah, the factory became a quite well-known spoil of war, and in some ways really a key target for both the United States and its allies, the Western allies, and the Soviet Union right after hostilities ended. And by right after, I mean within days of Germany's defeat, there were actually, before the official end of the war, there were film executives from Kodak, from DuPont, from the Celanese Corporation, and other U.S. film manufacturers on the ground in the factory trying to get formulas, intellectual property, taking raw materials, taking technologies for their own use. And the major target here was Agfa's groundbreaking color film stock, Agfa Color, which was something that nobody had been able to create elsewhere at the time. And those formulas became spoils of war that were then reproduced in other countries immediately afterwards. But the factory also became a site of tension between Soviet occupying forces, who eventually were in charge of this eastern part of Germany, what became the German Democratic Republic, and the Western forces. So you see these Cold War fissions and tensions playing out pretty dramatically at times in this factory. And so we can see how the geopolitical histories that have always played out through film factories take on new dimensions during the Cold War.
Film historian Alice Lovejoy is my guest. We're discussing Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. This is Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, speaking of the Cold War, you know, which emerged right out of the end of World War II, and of course, the demonstration of might that the U.S. displayed by dropping the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What role did Kodak, you know, moving back to the United States, what role did Kodak play in the making of that atom bomb?
Yeah, so I've mentioned that the company was in charge of the Y-12 plant, which is a uranium separation plant at Oak Ridge, and one of the three large installations in Oak Ridge. It was a very large factory. It was separating uranium so it could be usable in bombs. And the uranium that was used in the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6th, 1945, just about 80 years ago, was processed at Y-12. That's a crucial part of the history. It's a history that that isn't very well known, but that set the stage in complicated ways for what happened to the company later.
Indeed. And before we get to that, you also write about where that uranium came from, because of course that didn't just emerge at the factory gates in Tennessee. What do we know about the origins of the uranium that was dropped in Japan?
Yeah, so for this bomb, the majority of the uranium came from the Belgian Congo. And so this is another of the colonial histories, the histories of coercion and imperial relationships that I trace in the book. It came from Katanga, the province where the Belgian colonial government was operating a major mining concern owned by a bank in Belgium. And that provided, you know, many minerals and metals for the war effort, but in particular, it provided uranium. And so I track that history back to through some filmmakers from Belgium who were sent to the Belgian Congo during the war to publicize all of these raw materials that Belgium was providing for the war effort. And for Belgium, this was an effort at showing themselves to be good citizens and good international citizens. It was a very well-funded propaganda effort to make sure that the country would maintain its borders after the Nazi occupation ended. But it built on the backs of quite violent and coercive labor and on histories that had existed from the beginning of the Belgian Congo when rubber extraction began there under King Leopold. So there were some filmmakers who were sent over to make a film about this kinds of this extraction and about its contributions to the war effort. And I follow them through what they called their expedition, a very loaded term, and how the film that they made was then shown in the United States to show how enlightened, right, the Belgian Congo was, how enlightened the Belgian colonial administration was. And I also draw some links between the colonial rhetoric in the Belgian Congo and some of the rhetoric that we see playing out in other factories that I look at, so in and around Kingsport, Tennessee, and also at Agfa-Wulfen.
You mentioned earlier that the Cold War was to open sort of a new era, in a way, for Kodak. Tell us about the radioactive dust that was produced from the tests of nuclear bombs, obviously also the fallout of the use of the nuclear bombs, and how this dust was understood to spread and move and be detected as such.
Yes, this is where we get into a very complex consequence of military-industrial relations, the military-industrial complex, because Kodak had helped, played a critical role in shaping the history of the bomb. But then, you know, in the early 1950s, as nuclear testing became quite commonplace across the world, the tests in the Nevada desert were happening in 1950, 1951, the factory in Rochester started noticing spots on its film that hadn't been sold, that hadn't been developed. And these were little spots that were made from fallout from the explosions. Now, it wasn't expected by anybody that radioactive fallout would travel this far. They had studied this after the Trinity tests. They knew it could travel to a certain degree, but it wasn't expected that it would go as far as Rochester, New York. But weather patterns and precipitation patterns made it so that this particular area by the Great Lakes had a great more fallout than other parts of the country. At least it was observed at that time. So this is a story, you know, on one hand about a different kind of global force at work in shaping the history of film and its factories. And we've talked a bit about the capitalist expansion of Kodak as a company, how it moved throughout the globe, how it vertically integrated. But this was a global force that had to do with weather. Right? It had to do with rain and snow and wind. And the company found itself unable to do anything about it, unable to control these radioactive isotopes that it had a role in shaping. And so it began talking to the Atomic Energy Commission about this, and the Atomic Energy Commission began giving the photographic industry advance warning of weapons tests so that the company could protect not just its plants, but also its raw material suppliers. So I talk in the book about one of the cotton linter suppliers that Kodak was using, which was also getting these warnings that, okay, we're expecting fallout on this day, and so on that day, you can't ship cotton to Kodak. It's fine if you ship it elsewhere. It's fine if that cotton goes in to make other kinds of plastics, but it can't go to make film. So this is a story that's been fairly widely told. It was something that was discussed in Congress in the 1990s, but it hasn't really been linked back yet to Kodak's work for the Manhattan Project. And one of the most complicated parts of this is that while the photographic industry was given advance warning of weapons tests, people living near the film factories weren't given the same warnings. They knew there was fallout in the rain and the snow. This was in the newspapers, but they were told not to worry about it. But then these companies like Kodak and other photographic manufacturers were seen as too big to fail and perhaps as too closely involved in the United States atomic program, too involved in the chemical industry. So I think this gets at one of the questions that the book thinks about, which is this arc towards safety in film's histories over the course of the 20th century, towards getting rid of the cinema fires and the volatile flammability that had been part of cinema's history in its first decades with cellulose acetate. You know, this was a history that shaped Tennessee Eastman. It was a history that brought Tennessee Eastman to the Manhattan Project, but then it ended up impacting the company in other ways. And the consequences of making film safe have been immense, right? So a question that I ask in the book is, for whom are we making this safe, right? This is safe for whom?
Right, indeed. And of course, around things like not just toxic fallout, but so many things that are toxic in our world. It seems that the onus is on most people to prove that they're being affected by something that is being caused by companies or forces elsewhere. So I'm curious how, in that process of Kodak recognizing that fallout was damaging their materials, was the level of awareness of how something like that, something like radioactive dust, could travel so far and do such harm understood amongst scientists who worked in industry and the government?
Yeah, I think this is another fold in this history, another wrinkle in this history, is that that NAC official who was very involved in questions of industrial health in those years is very clear about saying that there would not have been a system to track radiation, radioactive fallout in the United States as early as there was, which is the early 1950s, without Kodak's alert. And without the fact that Kodak, I think this is a quote, needed information to protect its processes. So the company was aware of this as an issue, and it sounded the alarm, and that then sparked the creation of a monitoring network across the Northeast that was able to track where fallout was falling, you know, how long it took after an explosion for it to fall, what the meteorological dimensions here were. And so that is part of it too, right? That it's a double-edged sword, right? That the company got this protection, but it also helped set in place a network that would warn people in the future. And over the course of the 1950s and certainly into the 1960s, public awareness of fallout's dangers became much, much broader and much more broadly discussed.
Alice Lovejoy is my guest. She's professor of film and media studies at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. So, Alice, in looking back, how do we understand the toxic legacy of a company like Kodak? I mean, number one, is there a way to trace the after effects of the fallout that they may have monitored but also played a role in? And then more specifically, where do we see the places that the film industry, including Kodak, laid waste to the environments where they were located or where they drew their resources from?
Yes, I think the fallout story is part of a larger narrative, and a narrative that's really about industry in general, not just the photochemical industry. You know, many of the chemicals that film factories use and used are toxic, and all over the world, these were materials that ended up outside the factory in various ways, whether deliberately or accidentally. And there's some wonderful research in photographic and media history about this now. You know, many of the plants became, in the United States, became Superfund sites, you know, sites so polluted that they needed the government's intervention. Kodak had a major cleanup of parts of Rochester in, I believe, 2014. And we can see this across the ocean, too, in Germany at Agfa's Wolfen factory. So one of the key sites, the key environmental sites near that factory, is a former mine pit that was filled with runoff from the factory over the course of most of its existence. So this runoff created, you know, very highly toxic environment, you know, dangerous to plants and animals and people, that, you know, impacted the environment around it as well. And this became the subject of some dissident filmmaking activity between Eastern and Western Germany in the 1980s, just thinking about how the chemical industry in the area, and specifically the photochemical plant in the area, had damaged the environment. So, you know, we're living in a moment when we think that film has kind of gone by the wayside. I mean, it is coming back in certain ways, but most of the films that we watch, the feature films that we watch, are digital. But these legacies are going to stay with us for a very long time in an environmental sense, as will the legacies of the intertwining between the film factories and the nuclear factories, which is another story that I trace towards the end of the book.
So what have been the fortunes of these film companies and their factories in an age where everything has seemingly gone digital?
Yes. So Kodak is still around. It's still making film. It is the heart of film manufacturing worldwide. Agfa Vofin is no longer operative, but there are some efforts to bring back some of the film that was made in the factory and around it. But I think we're looking at a world in which, again, the majority of still and motion picture production is done on our phones and on our digital cameras and on our tablets. But I think it's important for us to think about these histories together. I think we talk often about our smartphones and computers and our electric cars and the deep environmental cost of these machines. We think about the precarious labor that is needed to mine the rare earths, the minerals that they run on. But one of the things that the book shows is how closely these histories are tied to an earlier form of image making, film and photography. So we can think about this through the case of the uranium mines in the Belgian Congo, where the uranium that was used at Y-12 was processed. Katanga, the province where this was mined, is now a center for cobalt mining, which is central to smartphones. So some of these fault lines, these historical fault lines in the extractive and the violent histories of film and photography are carried into the present. We can think about this in the case of Ukraine as well, right, which was recently forced to promise the U.S. Rare earths in exchange for military support. That may have changed as of this week. But again, these colonial relationships, these imperial relationships that have to do with materials, have a much longer history to them. And a history that stretches back, to go back to a question that you asked earlier, to a moment that we might think of as free of the disaster unfolding around us, the climate crisis, a moment that preceded that, right? So this is the chemical age that laid the groundwork for much of this history, and film was integral to that.
I'd like to end with maybe a slightly strange question, which is, how do you understand, as a historian of film, the ways that these materials, which have been so destructive and are actually so very deeply embedded with war making in the 20th century in a way I think most of us have no idea, how those materials may have also been used to, at times, certainly, of course, project a world trouble-free of none of these concerns and no sort of critical commentary on the world that we live in, but also, in places, utilized to look critically at the system that we live under and the world that we live in. These, of course, are not necessarily contradictory, but how do you make sense of the power of film in some way to be revelatory, including about industrial capitalism and the terrible damage that it has wrought?
I think that's a great question, and it's something that I've thought about a lot in the course of writing this book. A lot of my background is in activist documentary and in a real belief that the kinds of visual and sound work that we can make and that we can watch has the capacity to change the world. I do still believe that, and I think this is a case of both things being true. If I were to try to hazard a kind of what next answer to a what next question here, I do think we need to think about what scale the industry that creates these materials should take, and how we can make these technologies of image and sound making in different ways that still allow them to kind of critique the world they come from, which is what you're getting at so beautifully in that question. So I think both things are true. I certainly hope we still have the capacity to use film and photography with their incredible visual affordances to reveal the things that are deeply wrong with industry and deeply wrong with industry's entanglement with government and military priorities around the world.
Alice Lovejoy, it's been a pleasure having you on.
It's been such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Alice Lovejoy is the author of Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. Her other books include Army Film and the Avant-Garde. She is professor of film and media studies at the University of Minnesota. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.